I'm Seth Cropsey, Director of Hudson's Center for American Sea Power, Senior Fellow at Hudson. I will be brief now and then a little bit verbose later. My honor and pleasure is to introduce Congressman Forbes, keynote speaker this morning. Randy Forbes represents Virginia's 4th Congressional District, which in a special election chose him to fill a vacancy caused by his predecessor's death and has subsequently reelected him 7 times. He's chairman of the House Armed Services Committee's Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee. In this position, Congressman Forbes is responsible for the research and development, acquisition, and sustainment of Navy and Marine programs. He's also the House of Representatives point man for the Air Force's bomber and tanker fleets. Besides Congressman Forbes' programmatic responsibilities, he takes an active and thoughtful interest in the question that undergirds programs, that would be strategy. Mr. Forbes' service to his constituents is no less a service to his nation, and it is an honor to introduce him today. I'll say more about the panel members who are speaking and have some remarks following Representative Forbes. Would you please join me in welcoming Randy Forbes?
Seth, thank you, and thank all of you for being here. I want to also expressly thank the Hudson Institute for the good work that they do and for this report, and also certainly want to thank Brian and Seth and Tim for your work on the report. You've got a great panel here, including Ron and Bob, and I know that you're anxious to get to them and listening to this expertise because I listen to all of them and try to assimilate their thoughts on these subjects over and over again. But I've been asked today to speak briefly about the continuing case for aircraft carriers, but I'm going to put that off. Just like Seth said, he was going to talk about some of the panelists later. I'm going to let the panelists talk about this report because I think it will address some of those questions for you. But just to tell you that I'm not here today as someone who lives close to where aircraft carriers are built and therefore kind of have a particular interest there, but rather as the chairman of the Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee, because I will tell you, we look nationally at why aircraft carriers or any other platform might be important to us as a nation, and I certainly welcome the questioning that we're having there, because I think every time we ask those questions and kind of peel a little bit of onion back, we get better and better solutions for what we need to defend the country. I don't think there are many people who would disagree that we need carriers today. I think all you have to do is look at the Middle East and what we saw with the USS George H.W. Bush, where for 54 days, that was our campaign, essentially, against ISIL, and probably no other alternative we have today provides the same kind of flexibility, range of capabilities, and same degree of presence and deterrence and warfighting capability in a single package as our aircraft carriers do. Perhaps Admiral Moore put it best when he said, we're an 11-carrier Navy and a 15-carrier world, and that was in 2013 before ISIL and South China Sea and Russia have done many of the things that they've done to make everybody a little bit concerned about what's happening around the world. So the real debate that you'll see today, the real debate perhaps we need to have as a nation, is what's the role of the aircraft carrier tomorrow? And I'm not talking about tomorrow in 2015, but I'm talking about tomorrow 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, the tomorrows that come 20 years down the road, and the tomorrows that come 40 years down the road. Our subcommittee has been somewhat at the center of that debate for years, and as I mentioned, we welcome these opinions and the discussions that take place, and we try to get a variety of opinions. In June, I sat down with Jerry Hendricks, who's a well-known critic of aircraft carriers. We went to, in July, to the Naval War College and had the Halsey Alpha group tell us some of their ideas, which are a little bit different than, you know, what some thinkers might have around the country. We spent time with Admiral Manazer looking at what the air carrier wing, the carrier air wing should look like as we move down the road. We value all those inputs, and we don't know all the answers, but we believe we at least know the questions. And the questions are going to be, what do we need our carriers to do in the future, which I think is a major question we have to ask, and what capabilities are those carriers are going to need to do to be able to accomplish those missions. I think that Brian, Seth, and Tim's report seeks to answer those questions, and they do it in the right way. Because just from the title, you can tell two important things. The first one is, how do we look at the carrier and its air wing in a joint context? And the second thing is looking at the carrier's role in a high-end conflict. The first part of that's important because you have to look at the capabilities that other forces, like land-based aircraft, can provide. But you also need to look at the threats to other forces, like missile attacks on air bases, to assess the carrier's relative strengths and weaknesses. In looking at the carrier's role in a high-end conflict, that's important because in A2AD challenges are raising legitimate questions about the carrier's role. For example, how deep and for how long can it penetrate into denied contested zones? What roles will it play? What are the targets for its air wing? That's important because there are a lot of competing priorities and other things we need for the high-end fight. So the carrier needs to have a major role in those scenarios. And as the authors argue, it should have an important role. But as they also argue, only by altering course can the Navy ensure that the carrier strike group's contribution to the joint forces remains relevant to the nation's need and future warfighting requirements. That's a debate we need to have and we need to look at. The air carrier wing does have some capability questions. Have we over-optimized for permissive environments that we saw in the 90s into 2000s? Does the air wing need additional things like ISR and refueling? And perhaps one of the most glaring questions that we have to ask is the long-range penetrating strike capability that we need from our carriers. That's where we believe U-Class has an opportunity to fill that gap. As many of you know, that's why our committee has been rather committed to making sure that we measure twice and cut once when it comes to what we do for U-Class. We think we're going to see that moving, and once we have decided exactly what those requirements are, then we need to move forward with that in a very fast way. Now, let me close by telling you this. With all the questions that you will have today and you'll talk about today, there's one that I suspect you will not talk about, one that I don't think we're talking about enough across our country. It's a word that sometimes seems a little cliche-ish, but I think it's an important word. When we look at the Asia-Pacific area and what we're going to be doing in there, one of the things that come up oftentimes when we look at our competitor China over there is the word destiny. And they love to talk about destiny, as they should, because they believe they have 1,000 years of destiny that they can talk about. I think one of the strategic mistakes we may make for those who believe strongly in national defense in this country is we don't talk enough about our destiny. And I tell you that because I had some time ago the opportunity to have lunch with Tony Blair. I'd been invited to sit down and talk about national defense issues with him. And he made what I thought was some rather astute observations. He said, first of all, he said, I've probably seen terrorism and fighting as much as any world leader around the globe. And he said, in looking at all of that, he said, I come to the United States, and he said, I really love the United States. And I think about states like Indiana and Iowa and some of the Midwestern states that I've never visited. And he said, it has to happen that this morning people will be waking up all across those states, and they'll see a beautiful day, and they'll be going to work, and they'll be asking themselves this question, why should I care what's going on in the Middle East, or why should I care what's going on in the Asia-Pacific area? And he said, I just have one answer for them, and that is, it's your destiny. And I think as you look at America, we are different than the rest of the world, and we shouldn't be afraid to say that. When I look at my friends in China, they love to say, we're a big country and you're a small country. That's what they believe their destiny to be. That's not our destiny. Our destiny, and Tony Blair said this to me that day, he said, your destiny is to do good around the world. And America does good around the world. And so I would say to you today that more importantly than just whether we build another aircraft carrier or whether we get the right mix of our air carrier wing, that the reason what you're doing here today is so important and what all of you are doing is so important is because we have to get this right. Because whether we like it or not, whether we want to talk about it or not, this nation does have a destiny to do good around the world. But we'll succeed only if we get the right answers to these very, very tough questions. So thank you for doing it. Thank you for letting me be here with you today. Good.
Of Arabia, Prince Faisal, third son of Sharif bin Ali of Mecca, and played by Alec Guinness, for those of you who might have been watching recently, makes an early appearance. Faisal, Sharif Ali, Lawrence's nominal and fictional boss, Harry Brighton, and Lawrence himself, argue about tactics in defeating the Ottomans. The discussion turns to the source of British military power. Sharif Ali, that's Omar Sharif, says, guns. Colonel Brighton says, discipline. Britain is powerful, says Prince Faisal, because it has a navy. Because of this, he says, the English go where they please and strike where they please. And this makes them great. I think the prince was on to something here. From Asia to the subcontinent to the Mediterranean, the entire Atlantic and much of the Pacific, the Royal Navy's ships did the Crown and Parliament's bidding and transformed a medium-sized island in the North Sea into a global power. Rather than build a traditional empire, the U.S. Navy for a century now has been an instrument of constructing today's international order, whose important elements include free navigation of the world's oceans, free trade, the inviolability of territorial sovereignty and democracy. For the past seven decades, the single most important instrument of U.S. naval power has been its ability to accomplish both its peace and wartime missions, with the assistance of air power that, to paraphrase Prince Faisal, can go where it wants and operate independent of basing agreements. The aircraft carrier delivers a large portion of this power. Hudson Institute's Center for American Sea Power study reaffirms the usefulness of seaborne naval aviation delivered by large aircraft carriers in war and in peace. This reaffirmation is needed because the aircraft carrier is, as it has been since aircraft first took off and landed on a U.S. ship at sea, being questioned again. The cost of aircraft carriers, new weapons against which it must defend itself, and a shifting role for U.S. naval power are the chief causes of today's skepticism about the future of aircraft carriers and their execution of foreseeable naval strategy. This questioning is healthy, and I believe that it's productive. Hudson's study addresses these questions with arguments that my colleagues Brian McGrath and Tim Walton will speak to, and I'd like to take just a moment to recognize and thank them for the exceptional amount of time and work they put into this report. The study acknowledges that challenges at sea to naval aviation are changing, and it offers ideas about how aircraft carrier strike groups can be strengthened and defended as potential adversaries seek to nullify naval aviation's power. If it were not powerful, it would not be the object of an adversary's calculations. It's important to understand that skepticism over the aircraft carrier and the associated combatants that make up a carrier strike group, skepticism that we are hearing today, recapitulates doubts that have been expressed and answered by operational success for decades. Hudson's report demonstrates that questions have been asked and answered repeatedly. The questions change, but the answers speak for themselves, from peacetime operations in the Pacific to strikes against ISIS in the Middle East. I will briefly sum up the debate that's gone on, because I think it's important to understand that what we're looking at today is not new. In the years after World War I, carriers' greatest doubters came from within. The battleship Navy viewed carriers askance. Airplanes were useful for scouting, it was argued, and might be launched individually from ships, but carriers were too poorly armored, planes too short in range, and land-based naval air was the only option because it offered larger combat aircraft with greater range and payload capacity, so it was argued. These objections crumbled in the face of the Pacific's vastness. European powers might use land-based aviation because warfare on the continent was, well, continental. But projecting combat power at the other end of the Pacific meant aircraft carriers. Both the US and Japan built stronger, faster aircraft carriers and equipped them with increasingly capable combat aircraft. The destruction of US battleships at Pearl Harbor leaned the Navy more heavily toward aircraft carriers. Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle's aircraft carrier launched raid on Tokyo, and the defeat of Japan at Midway Island in 1942 helped dissipate doubt about the carrier's usefulness in combat. They were employed extensively as part of the campaign that rolled back Japanese power to the homeland's doorstep. At the end of World War II, the U.S. had 97 aircraft carriers of one kind or another in commission. The operational achievements of naval aviation in World War II did not end the debate over aircraft carriers. You might say it started it. Alexander de Seversky, founder of Republic Aviation, argued that carrier-launched planes' payloads made them inferior to the larger weapons-carrying ability of land-based air. Combat experience told another story. It showed that where heavier bombers were more effective against fixed land installations, they were much less useful, actually ineffective, against naval forces. Carrier-launched planes performed this mission with notable success in World War II. The Korean War proved the complementary relationship between ground-based and seaborne aviation. U.S. and British carriers bombed targets in North Korea for the month it took the Air Force to construct bases in South Korea. As the war progressed, it became clear that heavier bombers were less effective than naval air in close air support missions and against such targets as bridges and mobile units. When skeptics offered that carriers were limited to propeller aircraft, the Navy built larger carriers capable of launching and recovering jets that could eventually carry the then large payload of a nuclear weapon. A 1958 Proceedings article argued that emerging missile technology combined with reconnaissance could sink carriers. Carriers' use in the Vietnam War put paid to this. And then some. Carrier-based aircraft conducted strike, anti-air warfare, and reconnaissance missions. The carrier-launched F-8 surpassed the combat record of every other U.S. aircraft achieving a 19-3 kill ratio against MiG-17 and MiG-21 interceptors. Carriers offered safety from enemy attack, where fixed U.S. ground bases were vulnerable to North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. In 1966, Secretary of Defense McNamara testified that, and this is a quote from him, although the investment to procure aircraft carriers is substantial, our experience in Vietnam and recent study results indicate that total costs to procure, support, and defend overseas land-based tactical air forces are comparable to total costs of carrier task forces of equal capability, end of quote. Construction of the nuclear-powered Nimitz began 2 years later. The aircraft carrier has been debated since its existence. The ship itself has also evolved, adopting new hull designs, shipboard systems, employment concepts, carrier air wings, and the concept, idea, and operation of a strike group. There are many reasons to believe that additional changes, such as the composition of the air wing, development of submersible drones, advanced surface warfare technologies, unmanned aerial drones, will meet the challenges of anti-access and area denial, cost, and risk that are the subject of concern about the carrier's future today. The U.S. has a record of accepting prudent risk to defend itself. Guam today bristles with military capability and abundant logistics, projected meagerly by anti-missile defenses. Yet it lies well within the striking distance of Chinese military power. So, summing up here, today's questions recapitulate criticisms that have been made and answered for 70 years. The history of technology and warfare is a search for survivable lethality. The search progresses along two paths, the offensive and the defensive. Short of extraordinary and indefensible enemy success in cyber warfare, and this would affect all of America's fighting forces, nothing suggests the criticisms of the aircraft carrier strike group will be more telling in the foreseeable future than they have been in the recent past. Unlike the British, there is no other democratic state to which the United States can relinquish its unsought role as leader of the international order. Hudson Institute study shows that aircraft carriers, strengthened by recommended changes, which are important here, will remain critical if the U.S. is to continue to possess what Prince Faisal described as a source of British military power, the ability to go where they please and strike where they please. Now it is my honor to introduce the rest of the panel, but I've spoken long enough, and I think I'm going to defer to Brian here, and let's, as they say, get on with the show.
Good day. I'm going to move quickly through my slides so to try to get us back on track. If you haven't had a chance to read this study in its entirety, I would recommend that you spend all of your waking moments for the next 3 days doing so. I'm going to try to hit some of the high points here. It's worthwhile to understand where the study came from. I had a debate in January at the Naval Academy with a man named Jerry Hendricks. He took a sort of anti-carrier position. I took a pro-carrier position. But I was left unsatisfied by the outcome of the debate because I thought there was more necessary. I felt that there was a story that wasn't getting told, and that was that the aircraft carrier, which is being criticized by an unholy alliance of carrier critics who exist and always have, and a very garrulous Chinese defense press who feeds them with all manner of threat, were occupying the playing field essentially on their own on this question of high-end warfare. I didn't think the Navy was doing a good enough job defending the aircraft carrier as an instrument in the war that we cannot afford to fight, and the war that we cannot afford to lose. And that's why this study came into being. We have some eye test slides here today because I thought it would be a little bigger, but I hope you can make do. The executive summary. We make the case that sea-based air power remains critical to national security across the spectrum of operations, including deterrence, the conduct, and the winning of great power war, high-end A2AD warfare. This is important to note because, as I said earlier, I don't think the Navy has done a very good job of defending the carrier in that atmosphere. Secondly, we recognize the value and importance of periodic reevaluation of the efficiency and efficacy of the aircraft carrier. Senate Armed Services Committee has directed the Navy to go out and look at this. This is good. The Navy should have to, on a periodic level, defend its assumptions and its presumptions. We happen to believe that they will probably reach the same conclusions that they have reached in the past, as Seth described earlier. Seth did a good job about talking about history, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on it. This slide is designed to show you a stylized impression we had of the degree to which the aircraft carrier has been valued across time. Seth indicated, in the late 1950s, the early part of the Kennedy administration, the Secretary of Defense? McNamara wanted to cut the carrier force to 9. Lewis P. Johnson wanted to cut the carrier force in 1950 to 4. Operational requirements came up then that demonstrated the power of, wisdom of not following those prescriptions. We think we're in a trough right now. We think we're at a low end in carrier acceptance, and to some extent it is because of the cost of the carrier, to some it is some extent it is because of the threats, and to some extent it's because I don't think a good counter argument to the critics has come out recently. A second reason we spent a lot of time on history in this report was to show you that over time the Navy has in fact thought very deeply about alternative aircraft carrier designs. We broke out three in our research. The CVV, the last one on the right, sounds a lot like the Queen Elizabeth class, conventional 60,000 tons, something of that nature. Ultimately though, in each case, the operational requirements overcame the sense that something smaller and something cheaper should be purchased. It really came to be in the analysis of alternatives that led to the Ford class. This graphic shows the 75 different designs, both conventional, nuclear-powered, small, large, stealthy, non-stealthy, that the Navy looked at against a series of operational requirements. I show this to you only because I want you to walk out of this room believing that the Navy takes the mandate to study this question very, very seriously, and that they keep reaching the same conclusion is the result of in-depth work and solid analysis. It isn't that there are navalists with aircraft carrier models in their bathtubs that they just want to keep building big nuclear-powered carriers. We build them because they work across the spectrum of deterrence, presence, deterrence, and warfighting. In the next couple of slides, I want to turn from history to the present day to discuss the role of the carrier in modern joint warfare. In considering this, I ask you to think about the carrier the way that we think about the carrier, which is as part of a larger combat system. The carrier strike group, supported by land-based air, space, and land-based ISR, is a combat system optimized to project power and to control the seas. Often, when people analyze the aircraft carrier, they take it out of its system. And we get to portray this a little bit more cartoonishly than is maybe fair. We get the sense that the aircraft carrier is steaming deep into the heart of the conflict, setting up sanctuary, and flying 24-hour flight ops. That's not a fair or appropriate way to look at the combat system that is the carrier strike group and how that combat system would conduct itself in a high-end A2-AD conflict. The carrier and its strike group provide key capabilities across the spectrum of conflict, as I've said. The Navy's gotten a lot of mileage, and Mr. Forbes just mentioned it. Every admiral who goes up to the Hill talks about the 54 days. That's great. But if all we needed to do was sit off the shores of third world countries from 200 miles and plink targets for 12 hours a day, we wouldn't need what we have today. We need what we have today because the warfighting requirements on the high end drive that, drives nuclear power. Believe it or not, it drives sortie rate. The kind of war that we lay out a little bit later in this discussion values a lot of airplanes in the air at one time. To have a lot of airplanes in the air at one time, you have to be able to carry a lot of airplanes. You have to be able to accommodate them. You have to be able to fix them and maintain them. You have to be able to shoot them and recover them. All of these requirements drive you back again to the larger carrier. In addition, we face challenges, and we're going to go through some of these in this discussion. These A2AD systems are going to get more difficult, and they're going to proliferate throughout the Pacific. The Chinese aren't building islands for tourism. They're building them to extend their defensive perimeter. They want to push us even further back, okay? China is developing an access-enabled power projection force. This is something Jim Thomas from CSBA likes to talk about, in which logistics ships, amphibious assault ships, carriers, nuclear-powered submarines operate together. We saw last month how China sent an amphibious task force through the Aleutians. I think that's a small sign of things to come. In addition to the threat, our concepts of operations and the way we look and have been operating carriers for the last 25 years, and that's all I feel competent to really talk about because that's my experience, that sort of conop is brittle when you think about how a aircraft carrier would fight in this high-end A2AD conflict. Our forces face the likelihood of structured attacks by PLA missiles and aircraft, and Chinese assets are ringed by increasingly capable air defense systems. Additionally, the United States has enjoyed perceived advantages in a number of important military technologies, especially undersea warfare and also air superiority and secure C4ISR. I don't think we can count on those superiorities staying at the level they are today. The gap will continue to close. Couple of reasons. One, technology is international now, and two, to the extent that technology is international, it's civilian and not military, generally. Looking at our assessment of the threat and the needs of the joint force, we reached a few conclusions. The first, in order to deter, fight, and win high-end warfare against a peer competitor, the joint force will continue to need the capabilities that the carrier uniquely brings. In terms of power projection from the sea, sea control, and surveillance. Equally important, there are a number of critical warfighting requirements necessary to the joint force, and more importantly, to a theory of victory for the joint force that would go largely unmet or dramatically under-resourced in the absence of carrier air power. What then are these potential deficits? When we talk about contributions that will become critical, we're talking about a war with China in which first island chain air bases have been attacked, and they will be attacked. If you think an aircraft carrier moving at 40 miles an hour is vulnerable, what then is a land-based airfield? Those bases will be attacked. They have the ability to reconstitute. The Air Force is working on that, and they're putting a lot of thinking on how to become more resilient. Someone, though, is going to have to provide TAC air inside 1,000 miles after opportunity has been gained. We can't just steam the aircraft carrier and the surface force and the whole Navy and P-8s into a dense A2AD environment. We have to create opportunities. Long-based bombers will do that. Long-range bombers will do that. The submarine force will do that and do that very well. Cyber warfare will do some of that. But we will create opportunities where the aircraft carrier and its tactical air will then fulfill needs to the joint force, like ISR escort, like refueling escort, like bomber escort, like close air support. Things we are going to need to dislodge an opponent who has the advantage, at least in the early stages. Now I'm going to come to the most controversial part of our study, and that is we go through a very exhaustive process of handing critics material. We call it an effects chain analysis, but we felt that in order to be intellectually rigorous about this project, we had to recognize that those criticisms are valid. Those criticisms of the carrier, its strike group, its air wing, its support organizations have to be dealt with. And so we've raised them, and some of the ones that we brought up are worthy of a little bit of a dive. This slide, it's going to be difficult for you to see, but I can describe. On the left, the green line shows that if we have 6 aircraft carrier air wings that are relying solely on their own ability to refuel, no Air Force refueling, we can generate 32 total strike aircraft 1,500 miles away in an uncontested environment. 6 aircraft carriers to get 32 with today's air wing. If you add Air Force tanking to the mix, those aircraft carriers get you 226 strikers. That's current ability. Again, it's uncontested, an uncontested environment, but it shows the power of having fuel available. Our aircraft carriers don't have a lot of organic fuel. We do rely on the Air Force. Somewhere between 32 and 226 with Navy refueling is a reasonable place to shoot for. On the right is how that number of aircraft that are able to expend ordnance at 1,500 miles, how that increases in terms of pounds of ordnance. 6 aircraft carriers with Air Force refueling gets you over 3,100,000 pounds of ordnance in a month. 6 aircraft carriers operating on their own, refueling their own planes, gets you 224,000 pounds. Another vulnerability we have is mass, the ability to get a lot of planes in the air. That green line at the top is what we assessed at the ability of the PLA to surge aircraft out to 400 nautical miles from their shores. The red line is where they can, is out to 600 miles. And what we have shown you with the yellow and the blue lines are how many aircraft we can generate with Air Force tanking from that number of carriers, and how many we can generate out to 400 miles using organic tanking. The bottom line is that with 6 aircraft carriers and Air Force tanking, we can put more, I think it's 4th and 5th generation fighters in the air out to at that 600 mile range than they can. You need mass. You need to be able to generate mass in this warfare because they have a lot coming at us. This brings outer air battle AAW back into the picture in a way it hasn't been for a long time, which means high performance air dominance fighter aircraft. It's not going to be good enough to have a fighter operating from the aircraft carrier that is a result of compromise with the ground attack mission. We're going to need outer air battle air dominance again. Another vulnerability that needs to be discussed is logistics. What this graph shows, the red line is the number of CLF refueling ships we have, which I think is 19. The blue line is our ability to support forces from 3,000 miles away. The yellow line is our ability to support forces from 2,000 miles away. The bottom line is that if we have between 5 and 6 carriers operating in an environment, every single oiler the Navy owns has to be devoted to those carriers, or the carrier strike groups. Every single one in the Navy from the entire world has to be devoted to that fight if they can need to support from 2,000 to 3,000 miles away. We laid bare a number of vulnerabilities. One of the vulnerabilities we talked about earlier was the Buhl CONOPS. We have suggested some new CONOPS or some additional CONOPS that the Navy needs to think about. One of them is this concept of pulse power operations. The Navy has grown comfortable with what I refer to after a conversation with a friend the other day as the Mike Tyson concept. We get in there close, nobody can stop us, and we pound away. We need to develop a little bit of a Floyd Mayweather concept here, which is the ability to generate power, the ability to do it at the time and place and for an appropriate operational duration, and then move away. We have the sense that gaining sanctuary is the sine qua non of carrier operations. Against an opponent like China, we may never gain sanctuary. We may just gain opportunity, and we have to get comfortable with that. We have to get comfortable with gaining and exploiting opportunity that could be fleeting. The second concept we want to talk about is integrated multi-carrier operations. Most of the folks, I see a lot of former Navy in the room, many of us have operated with 2 and 3 carriers at a time. Generally speaking, what happens is, hey, you got today, we'll take it tomorrow, or you get these targets, we'll take those targets. We're talking about taking 4 and 5 carriers and taking those air wings and truly integrating them in order to generate the mass over target, the mass in the air required to deal with a true peer, a near-peer competitor with peer characteristics. If you've seen the movie Ender's Game, and you think about those kids in that laboratory, in that virtual environment, we need something like that in order to truly think about and work multi-carrier integrated operations. An environment where multiple carrier staffs, multiple air wing staffs, multiple fighter COs, multiple carrier COs get together and think deeply about how you would integrate air power. The way we do it now, if you had 4 or 5 carriers operating, the Air Force, who writes the air plan, would basically see each of them as an airfield, and they would then task those aircraft carriers accordingly. They wouldn't think of that air power as a unit of issue that can fight as an integrated system. We have to develop that in concert with the Air Force so they understand it and can employ it that way. Finally, a little bit of a hobby horse of mine, single naval battle, truly integrated operations with the Marine Corps, so that you could use Marine Corps aircraft more effectively for at-sea missions, and so that the aircraft carrier can become more of a weapon and more of a support force to larger land-sea interface kinds of operations that would potentially be under the command of the Joint Maritime Force Component Commander. I think I'm going too long. I'm going to try to blow through this. Aircraft carrier itself has problems. We don't operate them very well. We have gotten out of the habit of what we did in the 1980s, which was to shut radios off and operate in an MCON environment. That is changing. The Navy is working on that. We're beginning to do better, but we have to be able to do it really, really well. That's not going to keep us from being found, but it's going to provide fewer pieces of the puzzle. There are other things that the aircraft carrier can do that can mess with the ability of the other guy to find us. Those exist at levels of classification that are beyond my clearance and probably some of yours. The carrier can, in fact, field better ship self-defense weapons. There's so much electrical power generated by the Ford class aircraft carrier. It is a great place to think about putting a self-defense laser. Probably one of the first places we might want to put it when it comes to the fleet. Surface ship torpedo defense carrier is a great place for that in addition to large amphibs. Including recoverability. We have to take for granted that the carrier will suffer damage. It will get hit in a big war against a big opponent. We have to figure out how to fix it. We have to get better at it. We have to pre-stock big pieces of sheet steel in places where we can get to it quickly. We have to be able to be resilient. The carrier has to become more resilient because it is going to be more closely targeted. The air wing. Increased striking range, longer range aircraft, more stealthy, longer range striking aircraft. Sea control aircraft, the carrier air wing got rid of the S-3. In my sense of a high-end conflict, I have a sense that there would be a lot of sea control missions necessary for my air wing, especially early. New munitions and sensors, especially as a way to bridge the gap between our current generation of fighters and a next generation fighter. This is a graph that shows attrition. Hopefully you'll be able to see it in the report, but not the steepest line, but the second steepest line is 8.5% attrition. And 8.5% attrition a day for 30 days is less than what RAND was using in their study that they just came out. I think they used 10% for their attrition. That leaves you, your air wing is at 60% of what it was. We don't have the industrial base to replace aircraft that fast. We have to begin to build more aircraft, to have them available so we can replace aircraft to attrition, lost to attrition. I'm going to stop here after this slide because we've gone too long. Other ships in the CSG are also a place that need to improve. Surface combatants need independent ISR so that the carrier isn't the only platform whose deck is used to generate the recognized air picture, surface picture for the group. Better surface-borne ISR will not only serve the Naval Task Force more effectively, it will also make those surface ships more lethal. We need to figure out how to reload VOS cells at sea so that those ships don't have to come offline from where they are projecting power and exerting sea control. They can come a little offline, not go 2,000 miles away, get their holes filled, get back in the fight as soon as possible. We already talked about logistics. Don't have enough. Never will have enough. Need more. Okay? I'm going to stop right now. You want to just Tim first? Okay. I'm going to start with my study co-lead here. Tim Walton will present his part of the picture.
You mentioned that the bios are included in the handouts.
The bios of all the people here are included in the handouts.
Well, thank you very much to Brian and Seth for the opportunity to participate in this study, and thank you all for joining us today. In order to keep us on schedule and to get to your questions, I'd like to quickly focus on a few points. First, I thought Congressman Forbes and Brian's and Seth's remarks were excellent, and I think one of the points that's in the study but we haven't discussed as much to date is how the Ford class program is still suffering from the decisions made in 2002 by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Sort of as we see delays and cost growth in the Ford's advanced arresting gear, electromagnetic launch system, and other systems, we know the primary cause, a decision to pursue the aggressive incorporation of technology into a single ship, and the commensurate decision to pursue highly concurrent technology development and ship design while the carrier was being built. However, there's another straightforward reason for the cost growth in not only the Ford, but in many ships of the Nimitz class as well. And I have a couple of slides that I'd like to show. Sorry, Brian. Okay. So here in background, you could see during the Nimitz class program, the average duration of construction of a single ship was 7 years, 10 months. And the average interval between the delivery of one ship and another was 3 years, 9 months. The big exception is there in yellow. It was the period of two ship procurements during the Reagan administration, in which the average intervals were reduced to 2 years, 11 months. As we fast forward to the Ford class, the average planned duration of construction and the average interval between the delivery of one ship and another is about 2.5 years longer than in the Nimitz class. Time is money. And these long intervals in construction significantly increase cost, which as we look at the costs in both the Nimitz and the Ford classes, generally only decreased or stayed stable during the efficiencies generated by the two-year buys of the 1980s. As the Navy and Congress consider potential alternatives to continuing with the Ford class and potentially spending years and billions of dollars and resources to develop an alternate to the Ford class, the cost-saving power of serialized production should not be overlooked. When we find a design that works, we should stabilize it as much as possible and build it in numbers, even while continuing to pursue efficiencies in the construction of the ships. Second, I'd like to build off of Brian's earlier remarks and comments on the air wing. Our study identified three key missions in which sea-based air power launched from the carrier confers special advantages. These are strike, air warfare, and surveillance. Discussion of the U-class program here on the Hill and elsewhere has sparked the debate on the need for an aircraft that provides either long-range strike or long-range and long-endurance surveillance. Our study suggests both capabilities are necessary moving forward, either in the same aircraft or in different aircraft. Air warfare, though, is another mission that has received less attention. As Brian touched on, the carrier's contribution to air warfare is crucial to the joint force. The addition of the F-35C, EA-18G, and E-2D will play important roles in countering emerging threats with superior stealth, sensors, and jamming capabilities than the legacy force. However, as we compare the programmed force with emerging fifth-generation threats, such as the T-50, J-20, and other adversarial aircraft that will be developed in the next 20 years, the projected force runs into challenges. Interim options can be to introduce new sensors and weapons to current fighters, such as a longer-range air-to-air missile or infrared search and tracking systems to our F-18s. Ultimately, however, supercruising, high-altitude, low-observable enemy fighters would be difficult to counter with the improvements to F-18s, F-35s, and MFCA alone. And we will face increasingly superior, qualitatively superior enemy fighters. Thus, it's imperative that the force develop a future sixth-generation fighter that can replace Super Hornets, be it manned or unmanned. The Navy has termed this prospective concept FAXX, for Fighter Attack XX. As the Navy begins to analyze alternatives and as Congress reviews them, it's essential the program emphasizes a big F and a little A. There are other capabilities in the Navy and throughout the joint force that can provide attack capabilities. However, there is a glaring projected gap for an air superiority fighter with much longer range, capable sensors, and a large capacity for weapons, both to support Navy sea control requirements, which will grow as Chinese sea control capabilities expand, and to enable other elements of the force to project bombers, such as long-range strike bombers. Lastly, as we concluded in our study, the carrier strike group faces major constraints and vulnerabilities that reduce its campaign utility to the joint force in high-threat scenarios, especially those involving China. At the same time, the joint force will likely need carrier strike groups to play a critical role in those very scenarios. Consequently, those weaknesses must be addressed. I'd also like to emphasize that our study does not foreclose pursuit of other promising capabilities that could play a greater role in the joint force. And as technology changes, especially aircraft design and capabilities, and as threats evolve, the role of carriers, their quantity in the U.S. fleet, and their design should be rigorously re-examined. There should be a healthy debate within and among the services for the best solutions to the pressing operational problems we face. Consequently, it's my hope that this report stimulates discussion not only of the carrier or of the carrier as a system, but the joint force as a whole. For instance, we dedicate a significant portion of the report to the Combat Logistics Force. Improvement of the CLF and the ability to conduct VLS reload would not only aid the performance of the carrier strike group, but the entire Navy. and would perhaps improve the viability of attractive concepts and capabilities that increase the relative importance of non-carrier elements of the force. Over time, this can result in a force that leverages the best features of anti-access capabilities, in particular long-range missiles launched from land, sea, and air, and the best features of power projection forces, such as carriers, bombers, nuclear submarines, and surface combatants. As Brian mentioned, Jim Thomas of CSBA has a term for this hybrid force, an anti-access-enabled power projection force, and it may be what China is pursuing as they progressively develop the capabilities for global sea control while continuing to build on their considerable advantages in anti-access systems. I think our report clearly elucidates the role of the carrier in the joint force. So those in the U.S. that question the carrier's utility should ask not, why do we have carriers, but rather, why don't we have adequate long-range missiles? To conclude, the current trajectory of the carrier as a system is troubling. It does not adequately account for either the advances made by threats or the requirements of future joint force warfighting. Without the types of changes we recommend in our report, the campaign value of U.S. carriers will decline, and it will have a grave effect on the U.S. ability to deter and defeat aggression. We must quickly change course. Thank you very much for your attention.
So I'd just like to agree with a number of the points made in the paper and kind of foot stomp a few of them. The first is, the growing need for the carrier and carrier strike troop to conduct surveillance, air warfare, sea control, sea denial, and strike, but to do so in increasingly contested environments. Second, the carrier strike group's ability to provide some measure of sea control when and where needed, as well as to defend critical air lines of communication, really is a key enabler of the joint force, and that's an area that likely will grow in demand over time. I found the discussion in the paper about the need for multiple integrated carrier strike group ops to generate sufficient mass an intriguing concept that I think needs further exploration. I would concur with the need for an expanded CLF force underway replenishment to include VLS reloads. I think something we really need to do, as well as the need for more cost-effective active defenses for the carrier and the carrier strike group, including things like high-power microwave, railgun, high-energy lasers. The one point I'd really like to emphasize, though, is the need for aircraft with significantly greater unrefueled combat radius for the carrier air wing. This is absolutely imperative, and it's something I'll get back to in a second. It's necessary, but not sufficient. So all the things I agree with for the most part. There's a few things I disagree with, or I at least would throw a cautionary flag on. The first is we need to be careful not to aim behind the target in terms of the threat environment. A lot of discussion in the paper about China's anti-ship cruise missiles, anti-ship ballistic missiles, the PLAF and PLAN fighters, the numbers and capability, is really about things they're doing now or in the very, very near future. But today we are literally building the carrier air wing of 2025 and 2035. So we need to think through what the threat environment and how that's going to change by 2025, 2035. Second, there's an assumption in the paper about that land-based air power is necessarily at high risk and thus a growing demand for carrier aviation. While that's certainly true within the first island chain, it's far less true in the second island chain and beyond. Now, what that suggests is the Air Force really could and should shift to longer-range, more survivable aircraft like they're doing with the long-range strike bomber, but then also potentially more unmanned long-range aircraft like a follow-on to the Reaper or the RQ-170, sort of a stealthy Reaper. With those types of aircraft, for example, a land-based air refuelable UCAS, the UCAS, might well be operationally superior to manned carrier aviation for many of the missions that are discussed. And while carrier-based UCAS or UCAS would be a very attractive capability, a land-based UCAS could potentially provide that capability with more range and payload at less cost. So the question that really needs to be asked, and I'll get to this in a second, is if that's true, if a land-based, unrefueled UCAS-like platform could really do what the carrier air wing does, what is the value of the carrier? What is the unique advantages it provides relative to land-based aircraft? And I'll get to that in a second. As many of you know, I've followed the discussion about UCAS and UCLAS very closely over the last several years. And there's a discussion in the paper about surveillance privilege or surveillance-optimized unmanned aircraft or a strike-optimized one. That really is a false dichotomy. With a balanced design, a single aircraft can really perform both missions. An aircraft with, say, an 8 to 10 hours of unrefueled endurance, which can be 24 to 48 hours of refueled endurance, would offer a dramatic improvement in penetrating surveillance for the joint force and for the carrier strike group. That same aircraft could have a combat radius off the tanker from the carrier of 1,500 to 2,000 nautical miles while carrying a 4,000-pound payload, which is roughly three times that of the F-35C and five times that of the F-18EF. Now that's a game changer for the expanding the ISR and strike reach of the carrier air wing, and that's the type of thing we need to think about. There's a few minor things we may get talking to about some of the concepts. I thought some of them interesting. Issues about like the escorting long-range the bomber. Potentially, you know, but obviously the carrier air wing need longer range and stealthier aircraft in order to perform that mission. And I like the idea of the pulse combat power. That's sort of writing off the a large class of targets, mobile, relocatable, and time-sensitive targets that if you can only pulse at certain periods, you might not be there when you need to. So there's value in persistence. And I'm not sure if the carrier air wing needs to give up on that persistence. It may just need to do it differently, say, for example, with unmanned aircraft. So then lastly, three dogs that didn't bark that I think should have, or things that could have been more expanded in the paper. The first is when talking about the carrier air wing, the big focus is on range and more range. And while that is absolutely necessary, it's by no means sufficient. To operate in the future airspace defended by land and sea-based networked integrated air defenses, it's absolutely essential to increase the survivability of carrier-based aircraft. And a big ingredient of that is broadband, all-aspect, radar cross-section reduction. You gotta have it. So in addition to longer range aircraft in the carrier air wing, they have to be more survivable. And that part of that is stealth. In that discussion about, okay, let's say in the future you had this stealthy refueled carrier UCAS and you had a stealthy land-based UCAS, what advantages would the carrier variant have over the land-based one? It would have some, and I think they're significant. You don't have to ask Mother May I in terms of political access to operate from bases. You don't have to have diplomatic constraints on how you can use your aircraft. Basing flexibility itself simplifies a whole host of overflight issues and logistics issues. Then that mobility of the carrier complicates the adversary's defensive challenge. So for all those reasons, I think there's really a synergy or a complement role for both carrier-based and land-based ISR and strike platforms, whether manned or unmanned. And lastly, and Tim touched on this a little bit, I think we need to think differently about carrier aviation roles and missions. Is four squadrons of multi-role fighters really the right answer? Certainly that's not reflected in the history of the carrier air wing, which has had very diverse types of aircraft for specific missions. So maybe we need to think about, rather than multi-role fighters, whether manned or unmanned, a split deck. So think about, for example, manned fighters, an FX with no A, doing defensive counter-air and offensive counter-air, and then a penetrating stealthy UCAS as a primary surface and land attack arm. I think that's some food for thought about, you know, kind of moving away from sort of the one-size-fits-all multi-role fighter to more of a air superiority aircraft, manned or unmanned, and a attack aircraft, whether manned or unmanned. That's it for me.
I'm Ron O'Rourke from the Congressional Research Service. I'm the Naval Issues Analyst at that organization, and the author shared with me a copy of the report a couple days ago, allowed me to read it so that I could prepare these comments today. CRS, as I think a lot of you know, is a nonpartisan organization that works to achieve objectivity in its analysis. And very importantly, CLS does not make recommendations. It discusses issues, it puts out options, it does not then say which option it thinks should be chosen. And so consistent with that, it's not my role here today to support or oppose any of the recommendations that are in the Hudson Institute report, but rather to simply make some analytical comments on the report that might be of help to readers as they go through it. The report and today's panel discussion are timely, in my view, for at least two reasons. One is that a potential high-end conflict with China has become a central issue in U.S. defense planning. In fact, earlier this week, in another room in this building, we had a briefing by RAND of the new RAND report on the U.S.-China military scorecard. That represented, in effect, a briefing about the challenge, at least as RAND sees it and evaluates it. And meetings like this one present perspectives on what the U.S. response to that might be, and this is the Hudson Institute's perspective on that. So that's one reason why this report and this event here today can be considered timely. Another is that the Navy right now is in the midst of a study that it has committed to Congress to conduct on alternatives to today's nuclear-powered large deck carriers. That's a study that is mentioned in my own CRS report on the Ford-class program. One of the points that the report makes is that the European theater, including the Mediterranean, is reemerging as an important operating area for the U.S. Navy. It kind of went away as a major operating hub for the Navy during the post-Cold War era, but it does now appear, to some people at least, like the post-Cold War era is over and that we have entered a new and as yet unnamed strategic era that features, among other things, renewed great power competition. And that as one reflection of that, we may need to pay more attention to having naval forces, including perhaps aircraft carriers in the Mediterranean. The report focuses on this in part because if you want to maintain more of a carrier presence in the Med or Europe generally, in addition to the carrier deployments that we do to the Persian Gulf and the Western Pacific, it can drive a need for a carrier force with as many as 16 carriers, which is five more than what the law now requires the Navy to have. That is a number I think that will probably catch a lot of people's eye as they read the report, and so I think it's important to make one or two comments about that. One is that if the nation were to decide to devote the resources to building up the carrier force, it would take a long time, many years, decades really, before you were to get to that 16 carrier force, and I can go into the details of that. Even if you were to build carriers much more quickly than we do today, it would take a very long time to get there. So if you cannot get there quickly, and you have something like only 11 carrier force, but you still want to now emphasize operations in the European theater, such as the Mediterranean, by having a carrier presence there while not reducing your carrier presence elsewhere, how do you do that with an 11 carrier force? Well, one possible option for doing that is to home port a carrier in the Mediterranean. Now, many people in this room are aware that we have a carrier home ported in Japan, and that this has been the case since the early to mid-1970s. What's much less remembered is that we have that carrier in Japan and have done so for the last 40-something years because it was part of an initiative that was carried out at the time that contemplated home porting carriers in both Japan and Greece. We were going to set up a carrier home port at Piraeus, which is the port of Athens. And in fact, we were in the midst of implementing that project. We had already sent some of the surface combatants in that battle group to Piraeus. But then there was a military coup in Greece. And in response to that coup, the United States decided that it no longer wanted to go through with the plan of establishing that carrier home port. And so, if it had not been for that coup in Greece, we might be here today talking about a very familiar situation of having a carrier homeported in Japan and another one homeported somewhere in the Mediterranean. Well, that option is still available to us. It's not a perfect option. Forward homeporting of ships has certain risks and costs associated with it, which we can talk about later if you want. But it is an option. It doesn't have to be Greece. It could be one of our other allies in the area, such as Italy, or Spain, or even France. And some people on occasion have mentioned the possibility of homeporting Navy ships at Haifa in Israel. So these are various possibilities. And again, not a perfect option, but if you wanted to move to a three-hub system for carrier deployments where you're maintaining carrier presence in all three of these areas and you still have only 11 carriers and you're not able to change that number very quickly over time, then carrier homeporting is one option that might be considered. Now, in terms of options, I mentioned earlier that the Navy is looking at various alternatives. We don't know what they are because the Navy has been very tight-lipped about the study itself. The Hudson Institute report also tried to look at alternatives and examine them. You can't look at every alternative in a report of the length that you have here with the Hudson Institute report. Some things you need to leave out. And there was one option that was not included in the Hudson report, and it was one that was mentioned by Trip Barber in an article that he wrote about a year ago. Now, Trip used to be, and for many years was, the Navy's chief force planner, and anyone who knows Trip Barber will tell you that he really knows what he's talking about. So when he wrote an article that did suggest an alternative to today's current large deck carrier that is not quite the same as anything that was studied in the Hudson Institute report, then that is something that I think some attention can be paid to. It doesn't mean that anything in the Hudson Institute report is invalid. You could look at this idea and decide that it's still not as good as today's large deck carrier. So it doesn't necessarily invalidate, but it is a reminder that not every alternative that is out there can be studied in a report the length of the Hudson Institute report. Now, the report recognizes that it's not just the carrier and its air wing, but a larger system that must be analyzed with a lot of moving pieces, and that's hard. And the report did try, I think, to encompass quite a lot of these things. Well, as one element of that system, that larger system of things to be looked at, the report notes the recent press accounts about China having air-to-air missiles that can outrange U.S. air-to-air missiles and how this disadvantages Navy strike fighters, and how one response to that can be the development of a new U.S. long-range air-to-air missile. This is something that might be a matter of particular focus to policymakers, and the option of developing a new long-range air-to-air missile has been in my report on China's naval modernization effort and what it might mean for our Navy for some time. As another element of this larger system, the report focuses on things that are often overlooked in other analyses, like the Navy's underway replenishment ships or the ability to reload vertical launch system cells at sea. The report offers a particular concept of operations that Brian sketched out for you very briefly in his presentation. And I think that's important because a lot of reports only look at hardware. They don't look at concepts of operations. And so this report, again, is looking at something that a lot of other studies tend to overlook. Now, the concept itself that Brian outlined is interesting. I don't know if it's the best operating concept. I don't have the modeling and simulation capacity to do any kind of analysis on that. But even if modeling and wargaming by those people who can do that sort of thing suggests that it perhaps is not the greatest con-op, that doesn't mean that the idea of developing aircraft and weapons with longer ranges, which is a main point of the report elsewhere, might not make sense. You might still want to do that even under a different concept of operations. And even with this concept, it's worth remembering that at the start of a possible conflict, it's very possible that forward deployed Navy forces are going to find themselves well inside China's A2AD perimeter at the start of the conflict. So we don't have the option of assuming that everything is going to be out on the edge. There may be some Navy ships that are very far inside that because that's where they were on day one. I want to finish with one comment about A2AD. A lot of the discussion about that is driven by advancements in adversary weapons, things like anti-ship cruise missiles, and especially this, the anti-ship ballistic missiles. The ASBMs are often referred to as game changers, but being a game changer doesn't mean you're invincible. The Navy has faced game-changing weapons in the past and has developed counters to them. So just because something is new doesn't mean it can't be beaten. You have to work hard to figure out how to beat it, but you can do it. This is something we haven't had to think about needing to do for a long time. Again, during the quarter century of the post-Cold War era, we didn't have these kinds of things thrown up against us as challenges. We need to get back in the habit of saying, yeah, it's a challenge, but that doesn't mean we can't overcome it. And one other thing as well, a lot of people talk about these game changers in terms of the adversary's weapons, but there can be game changers on our side as well. And there are some game changers in surface ship defensive weapons that factor into this discussion about surface ship survivability, including the carrier. The report mentions one of them, which is lasers, but there's also railgun and the hypervelocity projectile. The report discusses possibly putting lasers on, but there's also these other two weapons as well. And in one of my own recent CLS reports, I talk about all three of these things. So when you have a discussion about game changers and A2AD, remember that the potential for changing the game isn't only on the other side. We have the ability to change the game as well in our own way. And this report that I talked about these three technologies is one example of how we can do something on our side to change the equation as well. Thank you.
There's time for questions and answers too.
Make sort of a comment. It's a very narrow comment. It's going to make Brian cringe because it's one of those narrow comments that's not mostly focused on the report. But I just simply want to disagree, Mr. Walton, with your comment that it was mostly the Rumsfeld administration's change that caused the cost growth of the CVN 78 program. Profoundly disagree with that. In 2002, the Navy was on record estimating that ship, the CVN X-1, at $7.6 billion. A few years later, they had risen that estimate to $10.5 billion when they had blended some, but not all, of what was going to be in CVN X-2 into the CVN 21 program. That's remained a stable price for about 3 or 4 years. And then we saw subsequent cost growth up to $12.9 billion thereafter. It's not to say that there isn't some attributable to that, but you have to look at the fact that there was poor cost of estimating on the part of the Navy. That $10.5 billion number at one point was on a confidence interval that the Navy admitted was like less than 40%. There were shipbuilder problems. So I just don't want to let that, what I consider to be a myth, go unanswered.
Is that microphone on? I think so. Okay. All right.
Well, thank you very much for your comment. I agree that there are multiple factors. GAO had an excellent report last week looking at the Ford class program and what were the reasons for that cost growth. And one of the reasons was, I think, the immature technology concurrent design that they spoke to, and I think it was that 2002 decision. Another major reason was the poor estimating, as you referenced. If I remember, the GAO report says the shipbuilder told the Navy it would be 22% more than the Navy estimated. And now at $12.9 billion, I think 22% more would have been $12.8 billion. So the shipbuilder was almost 100% accurate in terms of what the final cost would be. Yet the Navy, for reasons of politics here on the Hill, or for other reasons that, you know, as we look at the shipbuilding budget, probably hasn't been historically accurate in its estimates, chose not to follow that more prudent estimate. But thank you for your comment.
Other questions? I see a hand in the back. If you would be so good as to identify yourself and your organization, that would be helpful for the rest of you.
Yes, thank you. My name is Hermes Levy. I'm from OWS. And I have a general question as to what happened, if there is any study of, can you comment on how we get to being the first most powerful military power to what we are today. What are the mechanisms that happen to bring us to the situation we are in today? Thank you.
What happened to put us in the position, our position of dominance in the world had its sunset, or at least, the winning of the Cold War, the end of the Cold War was an amazing event in world history. It left the world in a very strange situation in which there was, I think a French foreign minister referred to the United States as a hyperpower, and we got used to that, and we, within the Navy, I would suggest, we began to get comfortable with the sense that we could dominate the blue water against anyone. Over time, that assessment has become less and less valid as others saw that dominance as the thing that sets our military apart. Our ability to project power thousands of miles from our own shore is something that no one else can do, and that ability is due to our naval and aerospace dominance. Others have decided to contest it at the same time that our society has become less willing to bear the costs of peacetime military dominance. I think that's probably about what puts us where we are today.
Yes.
Adam Siegel. Brian, as per my note to you, it's nice to see somebody actually trying to say these are how many carriers we need, rather than saying, you know, fighting hard for 10 or fighting hard for 11. So it's good to see a report like that. But when we look at 16, first of all, we're at 10-ish, soon to be at 11. How many decades is your analysis of how the and what would it require in the shipbuilding environment to get to a 16? Secondly, not discussed in the report, I haven't read closely, but I did glance at it over the past couple of days. What's the rest of the Navy that surrounds it? If we're going from 11 carriers to 16, what do you see as a requirement in ship numbers? What sort of additional Navy? Is it the Navy of today, just plus 5 carriers? Is it 20 more logistic ships, no other changes? What's the change across the Navy in size and structure?
I can do the first part of that.
Please do.
Yeah. Adam, I can do the first part of that, which is what is the shipbuilding and when do you get there, depending on the shipbuilding rate. And Eric and I conferred about this to make sure that our results were consistent with one another. If you were to change the carrier building rate, which is currently 1 every 5 years, referred to as 5-year centers, and you were to accelerate that all to 1 per year and do 1 carrier per year for 7 years in a row, and I'm not sure the industrial base could execute that, but just for the purpose of discussing it, if the industrial base could execute that without any delays and backlogs, you would get to a 16 carrier force by about 2030. If you were to build a carrier every other year, which is a little bit more plausible as something that the industrial base could execute, you would get there by about 2040. And if you were to do 3-year centers, a carrier every 3 years, you would get there sometime in the 2060s. So it would take a very long time under 2 or 3 year centers to get to that number, which is why I went into that discussion of what could you do in the meantime if your objective was 3 hub carrier presence and you really only had more or less the number that we have today.
Your larger question, the first thing I want to say is in the study, and I use the words very carefully, I'm not interested in whether the country can afford 16 carriers. That's not my thing. I wanted to lay out how many we needed, how many we would need to fill 3 combat hubs continuously and indefinitely. Again, words chosen very carefully, and those words have meanings. Gaps would not be permitted.
So that drives you to, relatively quickly, using my history major math, to 16 carriers. Do I think this country is going to start on a path to building 16 carriers? Probably not. Should the country get the water over and start building more, get us to a point where we can more often than not have credible combat power stationed forward in three hubs? Heck yeah, we ought to. What does that maybe look like, Adam? Probably 350 to 400 ships. They would be different. I am a big fan of something Jerry Hendricks talks about quite a bit, which are small, heavily armed, fast patrol vessels that aren't necessarily giant killers, but they are ships that make other nations think twice about where you are and what's over the horizon to back them up. I don't think I'm prepared to go through the 350 to 400 ship fleet architecture yet, but I will soon.
One thing I just threw in there with the three hub presence is that we could also think about how to use the big deck amphibs as part of that. And that gets a little bit to Trip Barber's point, that you know we have these other aircraft carriers. They aren't Ford class, but they can still project air power.
They can project air power. But they are not aircraft carriers. They are combat systems that are optimized for the projection of power in the hands of an 18-year-old rifleman. Their job is to support Marines. They cannot accommodate the very basic aircraft that, in my view, really makes an aircraft carrier, and that is a large aperture ISR platform. Until we can create a situation where we can put an E-2 or an E-2-like vehicle on those aviation assault ships, I will steadfastly deny they are aircraft carriers.
Yeah, and the corollary point here is that we're not talking so much about how to get there, although that's part of this, but this section that the three hub idea is based on what's actually needed. And the way to reach it, that's open to discussion. But if we're going to address, if we're going to try to address the question that the gentleman in the back asked about what's happened to American military power, the recommendations, the ideas in this report are answers to the issue of how do we retain the position that we had.
Can I have my nickel back?
Yes.
But Bob is right. We can use those ships to project power more effectively. And if we can't get the 16 carriers that I believe the country needs, we have to find a way to more effectively use them. This is one of the reasons that we are hawking single naval battle in this report, because that platform is part of the idea that you're going to put really capable F-35s on that ship and have them do air-to-mud almost exclusively is insane. Those airplanes should be used for much, much more than that. And that's something the Navy and the Marine Corps are busily trying to work out.
Robbie Harris here, former naval person. Congratulations to Seth, Brian, and Tim for a report. Honestly, I have not read it yet, but I think I know what it says based on today, and I will indeed read it. I'm thinking of Barney Rubel's paper from last week or week before. And at the risk of speaking for Barney, I would say that Barney's point is that it's not a question of if carriers or not, but it's a question of how many carriers and how are those carriers used. Regarding the how many and how they are used, he talks to, in essence, of a supply-demand problem. The supply issue is we don't have enough carriers, given the way that they're employed today and the way we intend to use them today. But there's also the demand problem that Barney talks about at some length. Barney reflects on the days before Goldwater Nichols, in which there was a sink PAC fleet and there was a sink Lant. and both of them were Navy admirals, and to largely they controlled how the demand signal was answered with supply. I guess maybe Bonnie is dreaming of a world in which Navy controls the supply problem. Navy controls the demand and therefore has some control over the supply of the carriers. Now, I think Bonnie's dreaming if he thinks that world is going to exist again. But I think he does raise a good point about the demand signal, and that the demand signal is excessive. And I guess the first question would be, do you agree that the demand signal is excessive? And if it is, what would you do about it?
Clearly, combined commands drive the demand, and the services are the other force provider, and we try to meet the demand. I think when it comes to carriers, I think the demand is pretty limited. I mean, it's for two hubs, one in the Pacific and one in the IO and Persian Gulf. So what less do you want? I think the question becomes, are there... Right. Now, we can talk about other units and whether or not demand signal is too high for those, and that's a fair question. But then you get into other ways we could do it differently with either more forward basing, as Ron has suggested, or thinking differently about the O-plans, which really drives demand, because then you're talking about what is the surge force. And that's where I think there's a lot more room for creative thinking about how we project power differently, including how we use the aircraft carrier.
One quick comment. In terms of policymaker demands for carriers, I'm not sure how widely it is understood among policymakers just how expensive it is for the Navy to maintain a carrier continuously on station in the Persian Gulf, Northern Arabian Sea area. Doing that while staying within your operational cycle and your purse tempo limits can require seven or more carriers to keep one continuously on station in that area. So when policymakers might say, well, I'd like to have two there, if you were to try to sustain that indefinitely on a long-term basis without resorting to lengthy deployments that go beyond your limits or breaking the operational cycle and deferring maintenance, you would need a 14-carrier force for that. And so when you ask, are the demands excessive, there's a dimension to that about whether the policymakers understand the strain that it can place on the Navy to ask for something. And right now, we're able to have these two hubs with an 11-carrier force because we have a carrier homeported in Japan, and it reduces the station-keeping multiplier for keeping a carrier in the Western Pacific from the 5 or 6 that it would be if you were to do it with U.S.-based carriers down to 1 or 2. The majority of the remaining carrier force is for maintaining that one carrier in the Indian Ocean, Persian Gulf region. That very lopsided math is not obvious to people when they just look at the situation. And that may lead them to think that sending a carrier to the Persian Gulf is not as expensive in terms of the burden it places on the carrier force over the long run if you were to try to maintain it as, in fact, it is. So people ask, well, we're going to have this gap in the carrier presence in the Persian Gulf and so on. Well, in my view, a lot of that is the system just catching up with itself, because there were times when we were trying to maintain more than one carrier in the Persian Gulf, Indian Ocean region, while still having the Western Pacific, while still having only 11 carriers. The way we did that was by lengthening deployments, putting the burden on the ship's crews, and perhaps by deferring maintenance and training requirements as well. You can do that for a while, but it will eventually catch up with you. And the gaps that people are talking about in carrier presence, in my view, can be viewed as a manifestation of that process catching up with itself and the system needing to reset itself to something that is more sustainable and long term.
It's also important when discussions like this move to a question questions of excessive, that adjective excessive, to point out that the people who determine what is excessive and not are the ones who vote. And if there is a understanding that there's a problem, then what is excessive today, tomorrow becomes something that's necessary. So it's a question of ultimately political will. And that goes back to the issue that I referred to a moment ago, was raised by the gentleman in the back.
Let me do a real quick one. There's a lot to like in Barney Rubel's article. There's a lot to like in most everything Barney Rubel writes. But Barney Rubel did what virtually every other navalist in this town and others do in this debate, and they take it as an article of faith that we are nose over. That he leads one of his paragraphs. We're never going to go back to the days of the 15 carrier force, yada, yada, yada. When he says that, and when he says it like that, in my view, I read someone who is saying, how are we going to more effectively use more limited resources? That's an honorable position, and we have to have smart people who think that way. I'm not one of them. We need more. We need more money for more presence and more combat power, because our responsibilities have not declined. In fact, they have increased. And so when I read Barney's, I looked at it, I said, this is a very straightforward and very common sense and enlightening piece, but it goes all the way from A to Y. The Y to Z is, we need more. Thanks.
Let me just put one thing on this about wanting more and the presence piece. A lot of that depends on, in the future, is on the ability of the carrier to actually project power. And for all the reasons that have been talked about today and talked about in the report, absent changes to the carrier air wing, the ability of the carrier to do that is going to decline. So this is deadly serious about the operational and strategic relevance of the aircraft carrier. And it's not the carrier itself that the question hinges on, but rather the composition of the carrier air wing. And at the end of the day, you know, we can get into all the details, but longer range, more survivability off the carrier deck, period.
Yes, I'm Russell King. I was formerly surface lineman on the aircraft carrier Midway, 1979 to 82. And I was reading Michael Pillsbury's book, The 100-Year Marathon. I believe Mr. Pillsbury is associated with Hudson. And he's speaking about China's 100-year plan to supplant the United States as the world's superpower. And I believe Pillsbury might have been involved in some war games. I think they were naval war games. And when the United States and China are pitted against each other using basically our strategic psychological concepts, we would win every time. But Pillsbury played the part of the Chinese using Chinese strategy and won the war game, I believe. And also in political strategy and the economic strategy, you might note that China has fewer budgetary problems modernizing the military thanks to the U.S. consumer. So, I'm wondering how much do you factor in the psychology of the Chinese when you're pitting us against the Chinese in the conflict?
It's an interesting question. I haven't read Mr. Pillsbury's book, but it's received a lot of press here in Washington. The psychological component that you refer to, I think, is critical. At the end of the day, the perception of the localized correlation of forces is what matters. Whether China knows it's superior or the U.S. and its allies are superior in the region at any one time, and there's a material component to that, but there's also the factor of perception. So we in the U.S. government, or not in the U.S. government now, but the U.S. government as a whole, we need to think more deeply about how we strategically communicate to our partners, allies, but also adversaries regarding what are our capabilities, so that the Chinese know today is not the day to start conflict. And trying to do a better job of that, not only with the Department of Defense, the patrols we conduct, with capabilities we demonstrate, but also with the State Department, intelligence community, and other components of the force is necessary moving forward.
And Michael would agree with that.
I think I'd rather have our problems.
We have have time for one more question. Paul?
Before I start, I want...
Thanks. Paul Giara from Global Strategies and Transformation. Before I start, I want you to know I think what you did is great. It's fabulous. It's only a first step. And I have a recommendation and a question, and I don't want the recommendation to take away from the question, so I'm going to tell you the recommendation first, which is this is so complex and requires this kind of free-flowing conversation and back and forth and what if and you forgot this and oh, we can't do that, yes we can, that you need to give the Navy a rain check. There's only one uniform officer in the room. He's got
civilian clothes.
Okay. But thank you for making my point. So my question is this. It seems to me that there's an intellectual and moral disconnect in this conversation. Because when the time comes for the Chinese and others to consider whether or not today is the day, they're not going to be impressed by peacetime hubs. They're not going to be impressed by calculations of days on station. They're going to be impressed by warfighting capability, and so I think that in the study, some of the most valuable product was the view of different ways of warfighting. The biggest World War II Navy innovation was the multi-carrier task group. The Japanese had it figured out on day one. It took us almost 2 years to get that organized. This gives great synergy, and you've talked about that. But that's different than peacetime hubs. Ostensibly, we're a global Navy, ostensibly, I say. So how many theaters, based on what you, Brian, and Tim, and Seth have come up with this warfighting doctrine, how many theaters can be maintained on a war footing? And in that theater, in those theaters, in each of those theaters, how many maritime fronts can be maintained? Because this is a way to back into what the real number is. And whether or not we can improve the carrier force so that it remains relevant, I think we can if we want to, but we can't think about it until we get to those kinds of numbers. I believe that's the subject for unclassified conversations. And that's why I made my recommendation about the rain check for the Navy. So how many theaters and how many fronts? I'll spot you 12 carriers.
I don't think I'm going to do the analysis on the fly. I would have to sit down and think about that. When I look at the analysis that I did and that Tim and Seth did, that says 16, it was from the concept of peacetime hubs. And you can malign them, if you like, but what I see them as are way stations to war. They are what provide naval forces with the deterrent, the presence and deterrent and warfighting response gradient that favors forward deployed maritime power rather than what's sitting in Norfolk or San Diego. So the degree to which you are able to position credible combat power forward in three important places to our national interest is the degree to which the Navy can swing forces to generate the necessary power in the theater where actual war is happening.
As long as there's survival.
As long as they're survival. Well, I mean, I think it probably goes for all of our armed forces, but, right. Yeah.
No, survival for.
No.
I'm not maligning anything. I agree with you, just that the next step has to be, what does this really mean, right, in terms of numbers and capacity and...
I think that's fair. It's kind of why I said I need to think about it.
Thank you all for joining us today. It was a very useful discussion. I'd like to thank our panelists as well. I think it's safe to say that we will continue this. Thank you all.